This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Jesse Kornbluth. He's the author of a new novel called Married Sex, A Love Story. How are you, Jesse?
Delighted to be here.
Well, I'm delighted to have you here. So I'm going to get this issue out right away because I think it's kind of de rigueur in a way, but clearly because you've written a novel that's about sex between a married couple, you've faced this issue that your friends and other people think this book is essentially a disguised memoir or autobiographical novel. And you've dismissed that, which I think is correct, because fiction is supposed to be fiction. But I wanted to talk about how that is for you on a daily basis when you're out there with people you know and they read this book and they think, that's this guy that I know, what's going on here?
Several women friends have read the book and they say, I can't look you in the face. And that is because it reads like a memoir. It's told by a guy. And the guy sounds like me and he has some of my opinions. And as you may know, I have said publicly, yes, I have been in a threesome, sometimes for as much as 12 hours a day and for years. And it was all at my desk and all in my head. I have to say, this was the hardest writing I have ever done. And I now understand why people do not write sex well or avoid it. Because it is, as I say, like climbing Everest in sneakers. To put yourself in the room, to get the emotions of, in this case, not one, but two and three people was really tricky. And one of the great satisfactions is I'm writing a new book and it has almost no sex. And the relief of not having to think about sex all day is considerable. Now I think about sex, you know, as much as the ordinary 19-year-old boy. I mean, just, you know, a couple of hours. I'm a lot happier now. But the point is, it's fiction. It's all of it. And various people have said, oh, you should be cagey about this. You should make people wonder. And I say, I have a 13-year-old daughter and a wife. I'm not anxious for them to be collateral damage so that I can sell 10 copies of a book. And that's what it really comes down to, which is no book is worth damaging, you know, your real life and the lives of other people. And so, yeah, and also anyone who's ever met my wife knows that she's not the person in the book. My wife is the most private person in the entire world. And I have written this, so I therefore get to say it. I have never seen in 20 years my wife naked by daylight. I mean, she is completely, she's an extremely sane person. And obviously, we have, you know, a relationship because we have a child. But she's just exceedingly private. And for her to have put up with the fact that I wrote this book in the first place is really, an enormous testimony to her. As for the child, people say, oh, is she going to read it? And I say, well, are you going to text it to her? Because there's no other way she reads. and she couldn't care. So, no, made up.
No, but I think, you know, what is interesting to me is that I talk to so many writers who have, whether it's the book doesn't have to have been about sex, it's just so frequently that people misconstrue that fiction is actually made up. And of course it relates to the writer. It comes from the writer's imagination, but we have this confusion, I think, between, this idea that everything is psychological. You know, it's almost like we live in this a psychologically defined world so that people are reading novels and thinking about the author in this as without allowing the fiction to exist. Do you know what I mean by that?
I know exactly what you mean. And this is a sort of roundabout answer, but for 40 years I was a journalist and I ask really great questions and that lets people give me really great answers. And after a while, I got tired of this, right? Because I teed it up. I hit it over the net, and then they hit it back, and it was great for them. And now I like Q&As. I like people to see how it happens, that it's a conversation. Which is to say, late in life, I discovered the kind of ego that many writers have much earlier in life. And so, to a degree, all writing is autobiography. All fiction writing is autobiography. I mean, it's. I asked a friend, who's a photographer, the other night, is every picture a self-portrait? And she didn't think so, but I actually think it is. And I think everything I write, it's all. I mean, I'm all the characters, as Flaubert said, Madame Bovary, c'est moi. And there are writers who have great imaginations and they invent worlds that are not this one. I'm not that guy. You know, I write about people who are right here on Central Park West. So, yeah, it is all about me, but it also isn't.
Right, which I think is an interesting thing. I'm interested in the social effect of fiction in that way. Not so much what the writer intended, but how people construe it. It just seems to me an interesting fact of modern life. But I do want to talk about the writing. I thought that you handled these characters really well, and I was impressed with the style, the control that you had. And I didn't think as I was reading it, oh, this is an autobiographical novel. But I did think that you must have understood these characters really well. There are three. I guess we should point out it is a threesome in between a married couple and a third party, a woman. And
right here, maybe I should just explain very simply. The guy's a divorce lawyer. What does a divorce lawyer not want to be? Divorced. Why do people get divorced? Somebody gets tired of having sex with his wife or the husband. Somebody strays. So what you've got to do is really deal with the question of adultery and jealousy in a marriage. And what this couple does is they decide if you're tempted to cheat, bring the person home, and it never happens, and then it does. And they think it's just 3 hours of sport, and then unintended consequences come in. Why is it, okay, people say, oh, married sex, a short book. And I say, yes, but not for that reason. I hate long books. I have this website called headbutler.com, and I get 20 books a week. And I get these novels that are doorstops. And I used to, as a joke, open them to page 400 and see if there was a $100 bill there. Because I don't get that publishers expect me to read, 600 and 700 page books. I mean, everything that is written now has to compete with much more than it ever did. When I worked at America Online, and it was back in the old days, we used to say, how long do people spend on a website? 8 seconds. Why 8 seconds? Because that's how long it takes for the thing to load if you discover you don't want to be there. So the fact, you are competing with fabulous television, you're competing with anything on a smartphone, and I believe books have to be short. The ideal reader for my book is someone who gets on a plane in New York or LA and gets off the other end and texts someone and says, wow. And I think that's how books are really made, one reader at a time. And so who is today's reader? He or she, that person, a person with more taste than time. And so great. I had to write 3,000 extra words of this book, so it'd be long enough to submit. And even now, it's at 40,000 words, 7,000 words shorter than Gatsby. So yes, I like short books. I like people who write short books. James Salter wrote short books mainly. And a lot happens in a short book that's between the sentences. And there's a kind of spit. They don't seem short to me. They seem to be the whole story. And so, yes, thank you for noticing, because obviously I worked on this book for many, many years. But the intention is always to let the reader make the movie in his or her head, to see it as he or she reads it. And so that's a 90-minute, two-hour, two-and-a-half-hour experience at most.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I mean, I actually do sometimes like long books, I have to admit, but I agree with you. I think that the interesting kind of occasion that we're, or the interesting effect of people spending immense amounts of time online is that it's not the shortening of attention span per se, but it's the need to consume so much information in the modern world that it forces people to surf, as they say, you know, to take as little time as possible to get as much information as possible. So, Jesse, I have another question for you. You mentioned James Salter, who happens to be one of my favorite writers. And I wanted to ask you, kind of, who do you think about today? You know, you had talked about wanting to read short books. Who are you reading?
Well, one of the things about Head Butler is it is the bitch of Amazon. And on Amazon, everything ever published is available. And most of what I see now, or that I'm supposed to be interested in, I'm not interested in. So I'm really interested in old books. And to me, a classic is a bestseller that never stops selling. So Somerset Maugham is a hugely important writer to me. And Somerset Maugham is sort of the spiritual father of Dominic Dunn, and somewhat a great influence on me. And those are longer books, some of them, and some of them are Cakes and Ale are short books. And they're interesting in style, they're fabulous in theme. Cakes and Ale is about a famous writer who has a wife who sleeps with everyone, and it's okay. It's an incredibly modern book. And when he wrote it, Maugham was the richest and most successful writer in the world. And people read these things. And so I'm interested in, you know, there are things I have to read now that are new. I mean, I'm reading Sally Mann's book about photography and her career. But more often than not, I am encouraging people to read books that they have never heard of or dimly remember, and they're grateful for it. I mean, at least my community is grateful for it, because they are told to read the Patti Smith book. They are told to read this new 900-page book from Knopf. They are told to read All the Light We Cannot See. And, you know, they start to read it, and they start to read these books, and they feel there's something wrong with them. There's nothing wrong with them. There's nothing. They just haven't found books that, I mean, James M. Cain, The Postman Always Rings Twice, and Double Indemnity. Those books are 143 pages. They were huge influences on Albert Camus. They're great reads. Great reads. That's what I like. And they tend to be shorter.
Well, and you mentioned Head Butler. I want to point out that I do read it every day. And if anybody who's listening here is interested, it's headbutler.com. You can subscribe, and Jesse sends you an email a day with a recommendation. It might be a book, it might be a movie, it might be a record album. And I like that idea that you are kind of in the curation and recommendation business. And I think,
well, you know, everyone loves curation. You know, it's really the buzzword, but actually they don't mean it, because curation means that you have to pay somebody a salary. What they really want are cat videos and bots. So yeah, this is something I do, and it's immensely fun. I went to a school where you had to write a daily theme. I like writing a daily theme. I feel it's like tithing, and I've met so many interesting people through it. I've been helped so much. I sent this novel out. I said, you know, early on, I need help. Anyone want to read a draft? I'll give it to 100 people. Within 24 hours, 750 people wanted to read it. And so I sent it to 100 and got really smart comments, really helpful. So, yeah, I invite your readers, I mean, I invite your listeners to come and to disagree with me and to tell me, as so many of my readers do, that I'm completely wrong.
So how many people actually, when you make a recommendation for a book, when do you start hearing back from people? How long does it take?
Well, you know, I have a commercial interest I have a commercial interest in culture. I'm not interested in being right. I'm interested in being effective. So the really most efficient way I have of assessing this focus group that I think of Ted Butler as is every morning I get a sales report from Amazon. And it's not that I'm in it for the money, because there isn't really enough money in here to do more than break even. And if I relied on Ted Butler for our income, we'd live in the park. But every morning I find out not who, but how many liked what. And the simplest fact is, on a day of review of almost any book, on that day, I sell more copies of that book than any other single seller on the planet, including Amazon. Now, this is not a staggeringly great figure, because if you knew how easy it is to move a book 500,000 sales ranks on Amazon, you'd be really depressed about the business. But I pretend not to be depressed, and I'm always gratified when, for example, I find a book like Lillian on Life, a book that had been orphaned because the editor had left the house. It had gotten zero reviews. A reader of mine said, "You've got to read this book." I read it and loved it. I wrote about it, and on the first day, I sold 125 copies, and the book began to have another little bit of a life. So that is thrilling. That is thrilling. When you find something that deserves an audience and isn't going to get it.
Well, and I think that's really important. I mean, it is also true that today there are very few places where you can reliably go to get someone's recommendation that you can trust for anything. You know, it's if you rely on reader reviews, it's pretty difficult, which is what a lot of people do. You know, you go on Amazon, you see the reader reviews, and how do you don't even know who those people are.
Look, Amazon has a program called Vine, and they give the book to these people in the Vine program, and they are allowed to review the book and post their reviews before the publication date. And, you know, they're, I gotta say, a group of real mouth breathers, because those people didn't get my book, and I'm really sorry it was a Vine. And, you know, they didn't damage it, because who cares about 20 Amazon reviews in the big picture? But they didn't get it. And later, people who got the book read it and gave it, you know, 4 and 5 stars, and things began to be a little better for those who care about those things. But I'm saying this, you know, and then there are trolls. I mean, that's the other thing about online reviewers, because people either have friends or people have enemies. The problem is, I have the luxury, the economic luxury of being able to do something like Ed Butler. If I were 25 years old, I'd be hustling for a career and I couldn't do this. And so I'm a little, I think curated content is perpetually endangered, and now a little more so.
Well, I'm glad you're doing it in any case. But let's go back to Married Sex. And, because I never want to give away the story of any book that we're talking about, because I have to assume that most of the people who are listening have not read it. And you've already kind of outlined the basis of the story. But I wanted to ask you in this story, and I felt like the guy, the male character, was, you know, he was pretty, I guess the word would be smug in his thinking. You know, he was like, he really had this idea that everything would be the way he thought it would be, as if he could control the emotions of all the people that he was involved with, or at least understand them. And of course,
you do realize you're talking about me. You do realize that.
All right. Well, I just called you smug. I'm sorry. I didn't
know. But it's true. But it is true. And that's the thing. I mean, look, at a certain point, you have a dim clue of your strengths and weaknesses as a human being. And it's not that I'm smug, and it isn't that I didn't know that in the character. His life works. Everything he does has been terrific. He's not rich. He's in what I call the upper middle class poverty cycle, which is, you make a bunch of money in New York, and it turns out to be nothing compared to what people really make here. But, you know, he's got this great wife and this great daughter and this apartment he bought for nothing when apartments were cheap. And he's got a great law partner, and he's good at what he does. Why shouldn't he feel that, you know, his life is working out? Why shouldn't he feel that he's got a little more control than he actually does? And it's important that he's like that, because I'm going to take that guy down in the book. I mean, he's going to be, as you know, on his knees and confused and heartbroken. And, you know, and he has no clue how this happened to him. And then he does.
Right.
So, yes, it is important that he be a winner and not be some, you know, neurotic New York Jewish intellectual like me. I mean, a guy who's out there. I think of him as like a young Harrison Ford. And, you know, we're making a movie of this book. So, you know, I was saying, if Harrison could only be, you know, 25, if Sean Penn only didn't have all those lines on his face, you know, if it could only be, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
So who is, do you have a leading character? Do you have the characters for the film select? Is it cast?
we're casting now. And it is a process which I do not participate in after I heard myself say on a conference call, you know, I really don't think Charlize Theron is right for this. And I thought, I don't want to be the guy who says lines like that, particularly since I'm barely in the business. And it's like, ugh, disgusting. And this is everything I don't want to be. So I have excused myself, and I do occasionally send the producer, Nick Wexler, and the director, Griffin Dunn, a suggestion, and they very, you know, say, but wait, aren't you writing a new book? Why don't you go write that?
Right. I was going to say, it's unlikely that they really want to hear from you on these issues. I think they would rather you
these
were...
They are actually close friends of mine. But the fact is, and this is the other thing, as you know, male friendships sometimes take on extremely abusive terms. I mean, you would think we don't like each other from the way we talk to one another. And that would be the furthest thing from the truth.
So you're not, or did you write the screenplay?
I wrote the screenplay, and I have to say it's 70% different from the book, and it is the book. One of the things about the book is it's told by the man, and there's a period in the book where the wife is not in his life, and so you don't know what happens with her, though, of course, you'd like to know, and he'd love to know. But the fact is that in a movie, you know, you don't have that luxury. You don't tell it from one point of view. You tell it from the camera's point of view. So I had to write a whole bunch of new stuff. And additionally, in the book, the characters are like 46 and 7 years old. In the movie, they're 36 and 37 years old for the simple reason that people in their 40s don't go to the movies all that much, and people in their 30s do.
Right. Nobody wants to see a 45-year-old married couple, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even though they run and are fit and all the rest of that, as Art Crumb said about his cartoons, it's only lines on paper, and that's what I feel. And people say, "Oh, well, you know, do you feel being abused by Hollywood?" I say, "No, I'm thrilled. And besides, I cashed the check. I knew what I was doing. It's fine."
Right. Well, and the it is interesting what you just said about the different point of view. I think that's important. That in the novel there is that you have to show this tension in the three parts relationship. It has to be completely different in film.
Look, men and women come to the story about a threesome from very different perspectives. For most men who aren't going to read this, this book is free porn. You know, there are four large sex themes. They're described minute by minute. You're in the room. And, you know, you could get sort of hot and agitated reading it. You know, as they say, men come for the sex and they stay for the conversation. Women come for the conversation and they pay for it by having sex. I don't think that's true, but it sounds good. So I wanted a book that men would come to because they thought they were getting one thing. And then I pull a little bait and switch. And that women would come to because, although I'm a male, I sort of maybe understand how women feel because I spend all my time with women and I prefer that. So I was very aware of a bifurcated audience and of the need to please both, the desire to please both.
Well, and maybe, yeah, that's interesting. In some ways about the book itself, but do you think that the third, you know, the character who is the outside of the marriage character is a photographer, and it seems to me, maybe I'm reading into it, but you picked her because of the notion that you talked about earlier that a photographer is always creating a self-portrait, and it felt like she was there to reflect back on them in different ways.
Well,
obviously,
also consider, but David, consider the kind of photographer she is. She's modeled after a photographer named Lynn Davis, who takes enormous photographs of icebergs and glaciers and mountains and the pyramids. There aren't people in her pictures.
True, but she demands, and you have a great scene where she wants him to look at her, you know, to look at her in the way that you would look at a person you're photographing. And that was very powerful to me.
Well, look, I cried from when I set up the book. I mean, it was, and I loved it. I am never happier as a writer than when I'm weeping, right, as I'm doing it, because the audience doesn't know that, right? They just get the effect of that. I mean, Flaubert wept as he wrote The Death of Bovary. And so I like that emotion. Yes, she wanted to be seen because the experience of being with David and Blair had changed her. And she had been very distant. She just wanted the sex. She's sort of like a guy, if you will. And by this point, she's not. She's a woman. She's got real feelings and has real feelings for them. So yeah, to me, you've identified just one of my favorite minutes in the book.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was a very emotional book, and I think you succeeded in the effort to engage us in a complicated element of human interaction. I like that. So, and of course,
you are this book's best friend, David. Thank you so much.
Well, I like the sex too. So I got to enjoy it on every level. So I thought,
you are an enlightened male, and there are only three or four of us. So congratulations and thanks. And I'll see you around the campfire later.
Right. Well, thank you. Thanks for writing the book. No, I did like it. So I appreciate that. Well, thanks for doing this with me. And, I know maybe you want to go write some more, but, I really appreciate your talking to me about this book.
Well, can I say how much I appreciate it? I mean, there are lots of ways to talk about a book like this, and very few of them are intelligent. And, you're in the top 5%. This was really fun for me, and the way these have tended almost not to be by this point. So thank you. Thank you.
Oh, it's good. Well, we can admire each other now, and I admire you as a writer. So, thanks for that.
And I, you as an interviewer, let's never meet.
Right. We have to stop now. So this has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Jesse Kornbluth about Married Sex, which is a novel, a love story. Go buy it. Thanks a lot.